This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about one of America's supposed cardinal virtues, and that is that we live in the land of opportunity. But the question is, do we have equality of opportunity? And if we don't, how do we get there? With me to talk about this is Alan Jenkins, executive director of a new group called the Opportunity Agenda, which has just released a report, The State of Opportunity in America. Alan Jenkins, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be here.
It's my pleasure. Let me start with a quote from one of my least favorite people, George Will, back in 1997, arguing against the estate tax. George Will wrote, "Equality of opportunity is an unsatisfactory aspiration." How would you respond to that, Alan?
Well, I think, Matt, there's no question that equality of opportunity is one of the bedrock principles of America. You know, we often forget that it was the founders of our country who found it to be self-evident that we're all created equal and endowed by our creators with inalienable rights. Now, to be sure, they were not thinking of women, of African Americans like myself, of a full range of people. But the story of America is a gradual approach to the fulfillment of all of those values. We never quite have achieved them, and yet we should all be able to agree that we need to keep trying. And so I think there's no question that equal opportunity falls within that category.
And every step of the way, there have been reactionaries and conservatives who didn't want to go down that route.
Absolutely. And there are today.
No doubt about that. Now, your report says some progress has been made over the last 4 or 5 decades. Could you list some of those?
Sure. For instance, one of the pieces of really good news in this report relates to college attendance. Women in particular have really begun to close the gap in terms of college enrollment. Some of the greatest gains have been made there. And in fact, African American women have made great strides in closing the gap in terms of college enrollment, actually dramatic strides over the last couple of decades.
Something like a quadruple increase, right?
That's right. And it's also true, for example, that violent crime, Americans' risk of experiencing violent crime has really dropped to the lowest level since 1970. And that relates to opportunity in a real way. If people can go out of their houses safely, that's about security, and it relates to opportunity to fulfill your full potential. It is true, though, that there are a lot of gaps that remain, even with respect to those gains.
And one other gain I think you mentioned in the report is the participation of Black and Latino elected officials. That's gone up dramatically since, say, 1960.
That's right, and that's a real improvement and something that we should be proud of as a country. It's also worth saying, though, that representation by people of color in Congress has been relatively static for the last 10 years, since 1993.
So most of the gains have been made at state and local level.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So where do you think opportunity is lagging? Where does it rub the hardest?
Well, unfortunately, what we're finding is that in addition to the kind of big gains that have been made, really the overall story of opportunity in America is a troubling one, that the stepping stones of opportunity traditionally, a safe and affordable home, access to affordable health care, a decent job at a living wage, are really moving farther and farther out of reach for everyday Americans. And the criminal justice system now looms very large as a threat to opportunity. We now have 2 million people in prisons or jails, many, many millions more who've come out of prison or the criminal justice system, but are faced with barriers to voting, to holding decent jobs, to accessing public services. Really, we're finding that opportunity is either stagnant or declining for millions of Americans. We also found in this report that some communities of Americans are facing multiple barriers to opportunity. So in housing, in employment, in the criminal justice system, and in other aspects of life, some groups, low-income families, many people of color, many women, immigrants, and others are really seeing the barriers to opportunity stack up in a way that makes it very difficult for them to achieve the American dream.
If you've just joined us, I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Alan Jenkins, who heads a group called the Opportunity Agenda, which has just released a very interesting report called The State of Opportunity in America. Alan, could you give a website where people might be able to get a look at this?
Absolutely. The entire report and the executive summary and supporting materials are all downloadable at our website, which is www.opportunityagenda.org.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about criminal justice because you frame it in a different way. You frame it as a question of redemption. And I've seldom seen it put that way, that part of equality of opportunity is the recognition and the making the way for redemption. Could you explain why you included it in just those terms?
Sure, Matt. We really found that opportunity is not just a set of national conditions, it's a set of national values that we should be living up to as a country. And those values really include equal treatment, economic security and mobility, a voice in decisions that affect us, a sense of shared responsibility for each other as neighbors and fellow Americans, and a chance to start over after missteps or misfortune. And that's what many Americans call redemption. The ability to start over is really a bedrock principle of opportunity in America.
There is a second act in America, then?
Well, there's supposed to be. And for some folks, there is. You know, we saw recently the incident with Vice President Dick Cheney. He actually gives a stump commencement speech in which he calls America the land of second chances. And yet, when we look at the way our criminal justice system is structured for most Americans, there's some who certainly do find redemption and a chance to start over, but for the vast majority of people caught up in the criminal justice system, it's the precise opposite.
And one way that they don't get redemption is in this area of political participation where you have felon disenfranchisement. And can you explain how that goes?
Yeah, in many states, it's really a state-by-state policy whether people are stripped of the right to vote by being convicted of particular crimes. But in some states, like Florida, if you commit certain categories of crimes, which are not limited to violent crimes or crimes of fraud and the like, you're stripped of the right to vote in the state of Florida forever. That means there's no chance to start over. And there are stories of people who were convicted of crimes long, long ago, have led very productive lives for decades, and yet they can't vote in their own state.
Another yardstick that you use, and you mentioned it, is voice, which is, again, something that a lot of people don't consider when they look at indexes of opportunity. Voice is very important to me. Obviously, I'm in the voice business. I've been doing media stuff my whole adult life. Why don't you discuss how voice is underrepresented or not equally spread out in this society?
Sure. Well, I think it's important first to say what voice is. And this is the idea that we should all be able to have a say in the decisions that affect us, and that's not simply about freedom from censorship, but also about an affirmative ability to participate, and that it has a lot of manifestations. So certainly it relates to voting, but it also relates to a voice in the media. We've seen media consolidation really start to shut out independent voices. It relates also to the ability to participate in, you know, the soapbox, to be able to speak one's mind. So, for example, what we're finding is that the racial and ethnic diversity of radio news organizations declined by almost half between 1995 and 2005.
That's a huge drop-off. Why is that, Al?
It's remarkable, and it goes largely to the fact that there's been a huge consolidation in the media business, as you well know, particularly amongst news organizations. And it's also been the case that regulations have facilitated that. So FCC, the former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Michael Powell, was very much a proponent of allowing that kind of consolidation to take place and was really unconvinced by the idea that it would really stifle independent minority diverse voices in the media.
But the evidence sure shows that it has. In newsrooms, in the print media, there's been a better story, though recently I think it's turned south.
It has. We saw a lot of good progress in terms of diversity in the newsroom of reporters and others, and it's only recently that's begun to level off and in some cases, unfortunately, decline. We still find, though, that there are some news markets that are majority-minority, in other words, majority people of color, and yet have no people of color in the newsroom as reporters.
So that's not representative at all. One subject you bring about and discuss in this voice section is the question of the digital divide. Could you explain what the digital divide is and how deep that divide is?
Yeah, I mean, this is the idea that really increasingly, in order to participate fully in society, people need access not only to computer and internet, but also to high-speed internet and to the knowledge and ability to access services. And so more and more, if you want to be part of both the public debate, but also just access basic services and information, that it's increasingly important to have access to high-speed internet. Access to those kinds of services really, again, go down to policy. Where is it, you know, the different levels of government play an important role in deciding who's going to be able to provide those kind of services and where they're going to provide them. And so we really think that there needs to be an affirmative plan for ensuring that there's equal opportunity and equal access to high-speed internet, to satellite technologies, to all of the new ways that we're starting to participate in the public dialogue.
Certainly anyone who looks at inequality in this country or at opportunity, Alan Jenkins, has to look at the question of our schools, at educational inequality. I read Jonathan Kozol's new book about the resegregation of America, and that's just horrifying, especially in poor districts. I mean, you have terrible facilities. They're not integrated at all. And to say that a kid in a school district like that has equal opportunity with someone who goes to New Trier High School in Evanston, Illinois, for instance, I mean, that's just kind of a joke.
That's right, Matt. I mean, it's certainly true that, you know, Brown versus Board of Education was decided over 50 years ago, and yet the signs are really that segregation is increasing around the country. Today, over 40% of kindergarten through 12th grade students are non-white, and the great majority of them attend schools that are overwhelmingly non-white. Now, that's not to say that there's anything wrong with attending a school that's majority kids of color, but what we found is that many of these schools were segregated intentionally during the segregation era and have never fully desegregated. And so, you know, the idea that they're kind of naturally made up of communities of kids who just want to be in this particular school is just not the case. And what we find is that the higher the concentration of students of color in a school, the less the investment, both in terms of per-student investment of certified teachers and the like. So what you find is that the concentration of poverty, the concentration of students of color also corresponds to a concentration of disinvestment in quality education.
Alan Jenkins, you said they were segregated or resegregated intentionally. How did that happen?
Well, the initial segregation of most of these districts came, you know, before the Brown versus Board of Education decision or you know, commensurate with it. So, you know, in the South, of course, schools were overtly segregated, and there was an elaborate system for keeping them racially segregated. In the North, it was more an issue of planning. So if you have the choice of where to build a school in the context of a place like Detroit, for instance, or Dallas, choosing to build a school smack dab in the center of an all-black neighborhood, often all-black because of housing discrimination that also took place during that era, you know that school is going to be a segregated school. We also had the context of white flight in many of those places. So school systems that were at one point all white then became somewhat integrated, but unfortunately many white students, many white parents fled the district and they resegregated. What you have is a system where a lot of courts found themselves declaring, yes, this school system was intentionally segregated, yes, it's still segregated, but there's just nothing that we can do to fix that problem. And so you have many school districts, especially in Texas, I think is the highest rate, where the courts threw up their hands and said there's nothing we can do to help promote the ideal of equal educational opportunity.
So here you have separate and unequal, it sounds like.
That's right.
Now, one solution for that, some people have been lobbying for state governments to give the same amount of funding to each district so that then there, you'd be separate but equal. Not that that's, you know, a perfect system, but it's probably better than separate and unequal. Is that one of the solutions for this educational inequality?
It is, and in fact, there's been some very important advocacy around the country to equalize school funding, and also to increase public investment in the public schools, which is just as important. I think also it's important for us to think regionally. So if you take the Detroit metro area, for instance, and think about the diversity of students from different groups, the diversity of resources and experiences, I think it's going to be important for school systems to be thinking together, and for regional conglomerations of governments to be thinking about how can we provide the best education to all the kids in our region. We've seen some interesting things happen around that in Hartford, Connecticut, for instance, where they've entered into socioeconomic desegregation, intentionally trying to create a mix of kids from different backgrounds.
How do they do that, Alan? Do they do busing, or what do they do?
In a lot of the schools, it doesn't actually require busing because, you know, Hartford is not that big, and in some cases, the kids were already riding buses. So really, it has to do with school assignment and often with, you know, a plan for new school construction.
If you just tuned in, the program is Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Alan Jenkins, executive director of a new group called The Opportunity Agenda, which has just released a report, The State of Opportunity in America. Economic inequality, are we getting worse or are we doing better there, Alan Jenkins?
Well, Matt, again, the results are mixed. There are some areas of progress, and you know, I think, for instance, we discussed some of the progress that was made on home ownership among some Americans, but overall, inequality is increasing in terms of economics. So, for instance, wage equality is now greater than it was three decades ago. Wages increased less than 1% in adjusted dollars between 1979 and 2003 for people in the bottom 10%. So whereas you saw a major increase in the last couple of decades by about 27% for people in the top wage earning 10%, you saw an increase of less than 1% for those at the bottom. Home ownership, though it's up for many different groups, people in the lowest 25% of our income population are actually home ownership, their finding is declining for them. And of course, we talked about the fact that 46 million Americans lack health insurance, and that's very much a particular problem for working families.
And you describe that lack of health care not only as an index of economic inequality, but also as a part of insecurity. You have a whole section called security in this report, and it doesn't relate to national security, military security, but socioeconomic security. And on top of the lack of health insurance, I mean, it's shameful to know that poverty has increased in the last 5 years, something like 37 million people living in poverty right now.
That's right, Matt. Poverty is actually on the increase. And at some level, it's not shocking that in a period in which the economy went south, that poverty would go up. But our economy has been improving along some measures in recent years, and yet poverty has gone up each of the last 3 years. And that's really a devastating problem and something that I think we haven't devoted adequate attention to.
Well, what can we do about some of these problems of inequality? You sketch out some proposals. Do you want to discuss a few of those?
Sure, Matt. I think there really are concrete ideas that are out there, some of which are new to our report, but some of which people have been working for a long time, to expand opportunity for everyone and to narrow some of these opportunity gaps that we've found. So one is really simple in many ways, which is planning for opportunity. So when you're building a new school or a new set of housing or new hospitals, when you're building transportation or even laying telecommunications lines like high-speed internet, to actually measure and do an assessment of what that action is going to do to expand or constrict opportunity along the dimensions that we've described. So is it going to increase equal access among different racial groups or men and women? Will it serve people who speak a different language? Is it going to increase the economic security or other types of security that Americans experience? So, for instance, when I live in New York City, on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, there are probably 15 places where you could deliver a baby. But in East New York, Brooklyn, near where I live, there are almost none. In closing hospitals in a place like New York City or anywhere else around the country, or in deciding what new facilities to build, one of the things that we should ask is this going to expand opportunity or is it going to constrict opportunity?
Alan, have you talked to any policymakers on this? I'm not thinking of national ones, but again, local ones as you are right now, because I know a guy who works at the city of Madison has been there for decades, just a great guy in the housing department, and I'm sure he would be open to using such a yardstick. Maybe he's using one already. Have you entered into discussions with policymakers on this?
We have started to have some of those conversations, and actually some of them have been really exciting. So one of the things that we've talked about is an opportunity impact statement, a formal tool that if taxpayer funds are going to be used to do a major project, that kind of a statement would have to be produced, that it would need public comment. And there's been a lot of interest in that. One of the contexts for it is the rebuilding of the Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina, so that those old patterns of unequal opportunity that we saw in those graphic images from New Orleans and other places don't get built in to the new New Orleans and Gulf Coast.
Are you having any success down there?
We have. I mean, there's been a lot of interest. Get back to me in a year or so, and we'll see whether the extent to which they've been implemented. But I think people really see that unless you focus on opportunity and expanding it, old patterns of inequality creep in so quickly.
What I'm worried about is, I agree with you about the need to look at opportunity in a very broad way, and also the need, as you put it in the report, to modernize the safety net, though I would have used a different word because I think opponents of equality can use a word like modernize too. And that's actually what's happened over the last two administrations. Bill Clinton talked about changing welfare as we know it, and he sure did in a negative way, to my opinion. And right now we have Bush doing the same thing. He's cutting away at what he calls non-Pentagon discretionary spending. So how do you modernize the safety net when politically things are going in the other way?
I think there's a big difference between modernizing the safety net and cutting the safety net, right? And what we're proposing is modernizing. So, we have a number of specific examples, some of which are quite big. They're important, but we don't expect them to happen tomorrow, which is moving towards a system of high-quality, comprehensive health care for all Americans and their basic needs. There's no question that that's essential, and the majority of Americans support that, even at the expense of increased taxes. 59-60% of Americans support universal health care for all, and I think that there's a failure there of political will, not national will.
Yeah, but what's that about? There are a lot of things where a majority of Americans agree with progressive positions, and yet it doesn't get done. Why isn't it getting done? How can we get it there?
I think one of the things we need to start doing that is talk about national values. As progressives have been framed as people who are not about values, but are just about, kind of frivolous issues of doing what you want to do, and things like tolerance that, of course, are very important to us, but are not the only thing that's important to us. I think we need to be talking about the fact that 46 million Americans uninsured is a violation of our basic values as a society, and that it's immoral, and that we need to begin to hold lawmakers accountable for that immorality and to phrase it that way, not only that way, but to make clear that what they're doing is simply wrong. I think that that's a message that, when added to the other messages, many of which are policy-based and simply about things like the fact that 18,000 Americans die every year because they don't have health insurance, that we can begin to start to move lawmakers in the same way that the American public in that particular case is already with us.
So you would urge people to hold their elected officials' feet to the fire on this health care, as some other interest groups do on single issues. You could have single issue voting on health care, I suppose.
That's right. But the state of opportunity in America and the work of my organization, the Opportunity Agenda, is really about focusing on opportunity across issues in a way that includes issues like health care and education and employment, but really looks at the bigger picture. Our Americans are all Americans. Everyone who lives in our country, however they got here and whatever group they may come from, are they able to fulfill their full potential as human beings in our country? Because that's what the promise of opportunity is all about. Now, obviously, that's made up, that the ability to fulfill your potential is made up of individual issues and systems, education and housing and the like. But it's bigger than that. It's really about the kind of society we are and whether we're constantly asking ourselves and looking at our policies in terms of whether it expands opportunity or not.
And I think that's why that threat, I think, is why conservatives like George Will are against equality of opportunity. You don't go whole hog on equality of opportunity. And by that, I mean you're not calling for the redistribution of income or wealth. Did you consider that?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that equal opportunity means that everyone has a fair chance. It doesn't mean necessarily that outcomes are always going to be the same, but when you see big gaps in income, in housing possibilities, in healthcare based on things like race that have nothing to do with, you know, whether you should be able to get healthcare or not, then you know there's a problem. You know, I think conservatives like to argue that, well, you know, some groups just make poorer choices than others. But I never met anybody who didn't want healthcare when they needed it. And so, you know, I think it's important to kind of get beyond that kind of back and forth.
But it may be that you really can't have true equality of opportunity with such a grotesque distribution of wealth and income that we have here.
Well, I think that may well be true, and I think, frankly, that if we're able to provide truly equal opportunity in places like, you know, jobs and employment, and housing and healthcare and the criminal justice system, then you'll begin to see income and wealth, but more importantly, people's ability to really participate fully in society start to shift. But I think we need to start to look at all of those things and all the policy decisions we make through this frame of opportunity.
I was a little surprised that you didn't come straight out and advocate in this report, Alan Jenkins, for free college education, or did you think that your reforms were going to get there anyway?
Well, we're looking in terms of what people's access is. So we believe that everyone who's capable of doing the work should be able to go to a high-quality college or university, which of course presupposes that, you know, our belief that they should be able to go through K-12 education that's of high quality and that's free. I don't think we've focused particularly on how that access should be provided, although we do talk about grants instead of student loans, and loans have overtaken grants in a lot of areas. So ultimately the measure is, are people getting opportunity? If we're finding that people are able to attend college, to get in, to send their kids there and to afford it, then it's not bankrupting them in other ways, then, you know, by one measure we're succeeding. If we're not, and that's certainly not where we are today, then we need to look at ways of making college affordable for everybody.
I mean, the weird thing about some college grants now, I mean, leaving aside Pell Grants, which you say in your report should be doubled, and that state and local grants from government agencies should increase as well, is that the colleges themselves are giving more and more grants that are irrespective of need. Why do you think that is? Doesn't that trouble you?
It does, and I think that it's really driven by, you know, a desire by many universities to bring in kids who will really drive up their numbers in the U.S. News and World Report and those kinds of things, and not really focusing on the responsibility that higher education has to educate the whole society. And then I think there are just questions of funding priorities that are wrong, that, you know, it should be the responsibility of state and federal government to make sure that every kid who can do the work gets a college education. That's just smart for all of us. That's not only a question of individual opportunity. It has to do with, you know, the next generation of doctors and scientists and teachers and the people who we need to make our country a prosperous one.
You've been listening to Progressive Radio. My guest, Alan Jenkins, who heads the Opportunity Agenda and has just released a report called The State of Opportunity in America. Alan, can you tell us how we can obtain copies of this interesting report?
Absolutely. The report can be downloaded from our website, which is www.opportunityagenda.org, and we hope your listeners will do that right away. And we're also looking for feedback, so there are a couple of places on our website where you can give us your comments and thoughts and ideas, and I hope you'll do that too.
Well, Alan Jenkins, it's been great talking with you.
Thanks. It's a pleasure, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.